Black Agenda Radio, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, New Orleans approaches the five-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, with as many as 150,000 of her residents still in exile. Wycliffe Jean's presidential candidacy plays into the hands of the foreign occupiers of Haiti. And Dr. Jared Ball has a commentary on digital Obama League.
But first, momentum continues to build toward the October 2nd March for Jobs in Washington. The action was first called for by the NAACP and SEIU Local 1199 and has now been endorsed by the entire labor movement. We spoke with Alan Benjamin of the Workers' Emergency Recovery Campaign, which advocates that the government create 15 million public work jobs. Will the October 2nd march mark a turning point when organized labor makes real demands of the Obama administration?
I think that it represents an important shift in that the AFL-CIO leadership realizes that the inside strategy, trying to meet at the table and get a hearing from President Obama, is a failed policy, and that they have to be out in the streets raising demands. I think it's a shift because it shows that they understand we have to be out in the streets, we have to be raising the issues that are dear to us. I'm not sure it's a turning point, because the way you frame the question is absolutely correct. Are they going to be out in the street raising the demands that address the urgent needs of working people, the poor, all the oppressed? And that's where there is still a question mark. The demands at this point that the AFL-CIO, at any rate, has put forward are very general. And I think the reason that our campaign, the Workers' Emergency Recovery Campaign, is focused so much of its energy on the specific demands, it's so that these aren't demands that are watered down, that can find common ground with the politicians in November. And therefore, October 2nd would not be a turning point. It would just merely be a place where we're organizing support for those very same politicians who've been turning their backs on us and stabbing us in the back. So it's a very contradictory situation, one that many of us in the rank and file, in their unions and even secondary leaderships, want to seize on to say, yes, thank you. We want to be out in the streets. We have to be out in the streets. That's where we have our strength. That's where we want our rights, our demands, civil rights, eight-hour day, women's suffrage, and the rest. But we can only fulfill that turning point promise or mandate if we're out there demanding an end to the wars and redirecting funding from the war to rebuilding our country. Only if we're there demanding single-payer health care, not just the minimal jobs program that Obama has, you know, built through so-called, he doesn't even have a jobs program, but the minimal thing that he's putting forward about some having the private sector bail us out. No, a real jobs demands minimum 15 million jobs, a WPA-type public jobs program. Making sure that immigrants are not continued to be scapegoated as the Obama plan announced July 1st still does, with militarizing the border and these guest worker programs and the criminalization of the immigrants. So if we're out there, not with a revolutionary program, but with a fighting program that represents a step forward, then this could be a true turning point. And I think that is going to be decided by the movement from below. Just to finish this one question, I had a very good discussion with a leader of a Teamster local yesterday, a very militant black militant leader from in New York, who said, this is what we've got to do. We've got to be out there and build October 2nd with our demands and imbue the content, whether the demands are general in the calls. And frankly, there's a very good reference point for us, August 28th, Operation Push and UAW organizing a mass demonstration for jobs, justice, and peace. And they're calling, for example, to end the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, save lives, and redirect the war budget toward rebuilding America. That kind of language, if we can bring into October 2nd, if that spirit and that mobilization, then the rank and file can use this opening and really mark this turning point. It's up to us to make it happen.
Is there a fight going on within the ranks of labor about the character and nature of the demands that will be put forward on October 2nd?
There's a beginning of a discussion. I wouldn't say there's a fight yet, but the fact that through our small campaign, we've been able to generate quite a bit of interest, and we're getting calls, the phone's ringing off the hook with people saying, fantastic, we want to adopt resolutions like the one you've suggested that puts forward those demands, that gives a reason for people to be out there. People aren't going to come out on October 2nd if it's just very general and very vague, and if it looks like this is just a launching point for electing more politicians who are going to turn their backs on us in November. They're only going to come out if they're inspired with, finally, we're out in the streets. Finally, we're going to be taking up our demands. Finally, we're fighting. And so that's going to happen only to the extent that we build this fire from below.
Speaking of generalities and vagueness, NAACP Chief Ben Jealous has come out with statements calling for making demands of Congress. But making demands of Congress is like making demands of no one in particular at all. And notably left out were demands of this Obama administration.
Well, there you have it. There you have it. So it's going to inevitably there's going to be pressures, especially given the the election period, to try to water down demands, to try to not put heat on the administration and the guys that, well, they're being attacked by the Tea Party and all these other folks, and we don't want to join that chorus. What those folks don't realize is by letting things continue as they are, by not placing demands on Obama, by not even within the labor movement, a leader, Fred Mason from the Maryland AFL-CIO, has always said that Obama's not going to do anything unless we make him do it. Now, that I may not share totally that point of view about the nature of the administration or how one goes about making change in this country, but it shows that at least the labor movement understands that it's up to us to build the kind of movement from below that will compel the politicians to listen to us and to change, because they have no choice, because otherwise there's going to be such deep unrest that that's the best option for them is to make good and to give solution to our demands. But that language that's the positive side of it. What I'm trying to say is that sentiment, hopefully, of confronting the administration and making the administration do what we want, hopefully that will prevail, and not the other, which is to say we want to protect the president because if we don't, he's going to be attacked by the right. He's being attacked because, and by everybody, because he hasn't done what he promised. He hasn't addressed the needs, and the right wing is using that to the max to go after him. So we can't get into that game. We have to be out there around our issues, our demands, and only that.
Let's be frank. Can't we expect tremendous pressures to transform this march into a rah-rah celebration of the administration rather than a confrontation, or at least a time to air these legitimate demands?
Of course there's going to be pressures. Absolutely. They're going to be immense. But keep in mind one thing. The AFL-CIO, for example, did not want to do this demonstration on October 2nd. It was dragged into it because of two things. One, the fact that NAACP and SEIU 1199 had said this. They had argued against us. We'd been clamoring all year for a Solidarity Day 3 march. And they said, no, 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 it's going to detract from mobilizing support for the politicians, the Democrats we want elected in November. And if they had to do this and to take funds away from doing that, because there's a pledge that it's going to be just speakers from labor and community allies, if they do that, it's because they realize that they're at an impasse, that the politicians aren't listening to us, that they have to do something different. So it's more contradictory. They have to do something. That gives us the opening, and I want to stress that. It's what we do. We're not responsible for what the AFL-CIO or NAACP or anybody else says. They'll do, and they might want to transform that into this kind of a rally. But if we can, the fact that we're out on the streets, if we can mobilize with our banners and our slogans and our contingents and our feeder rallies and make this a movement that does confront, I'm not sure that that can be contained.
That is the question. Do you are you confident it will be possible for people to organize with their banners, their slogans, and their contingents?
It's going to happen. It's happening already. It's happening. That's what we're calling for. We're calling for using this opening and saying, folks, we're out there with our demands. And it's going to happen. I don't think anybody can stop it.
Tell us more about the Solidarity Day 3 campaign.
Your listeners might remember that in 1981 and later in 84, the National Labor Movement, which was then united, wasn't split as it is today between AFL-CIO and a wing that left the AFL-CIO in 2005 to constitute Change to Win. Back in the 80s, they organized two marches of close to a million people. Now then, it was around the issue of the Reagan administration's attacks on the air traffic controllers and then the mine workers in particular. We, early on in this year, many unionist activists who constituted this Workers' Emergency Recovery Campaign, and that campaign includes Sister Cynthia McKinney, Sister Colia Clark, and Cindy Sheehan, union folks, many Latino labor organizers, farm worker leaders, we decided that we had to be out in the streets, that without a campaign that insisted on our demands, that this was all going to go nowhere. It was going to be lobbying, the inside strategy, we're dead. And so we called for building a Solidarity Day 3 demonstration, and we were proposing the spring of 2010, or at the latest, August 28th. We were hesitant about anything that would take place in October because of the proximity with the election, and as you said, it would just be used as a trampoline to get Democrats elected. So we didn't succeed with the Solidarity 3 campaign. It was rejected, and it only came back after SEIU 1199 and NAACP for their own reasons, because they realized that they're not getting a hearing on anything, decided to be out in the streets. So, it's a campaign that generated a lot of interest, and the reason state AFL-CIO bodies, state federations, community organizations, rank and file organizations jumped on board with what we were saying is that they wanted to build a wing within the labor movement. A wing I would call a class struggle left wing that wants to be out fighting. And so what we're responsible for, we believe, is building that wing. We don't know what the other folks are going to want to do or not, but we're going to build our contingents, our banners, our demands, our movement. And that we can do, and it's very useful that there's that call for the second, because we can run with that and say, yes, you're right, and use their statements against them. and build this movement and saying, well, we're doing what you've asked us to do. We're out there and we're expressing what needs to be said. And can you challenge that? Can anybody challenge the fact that we need 15 million jobs? We need a WPA. In fact, Richard Trump is saying all the things that need to be done, just that he's not doing it. So that's the contradiction. We're seizing on all the good statements they make, if only just to, you know, cover other policies which are not good. But we're using them and running with them, and it's going to put them in a bind. So we're very happy to do this. We're glad that Richard Trump is finally saying these things, and so now put your money where your mouth is. Let's build.
That was Alan Benjamin of the Workers' Emergency Recovery Campaign.
5 years ago, on August 28th, Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. Government policy in the wake of the storm changed the city in profound ways to the vast disadvantage of its black population. Lance Hill is executive director of the Southern Institute for Education and Research at Tulane University and co-author of a report on the state of New Orleans 5 years after the flood. Dr. Hill talks about what the study found.
I think it's quite different than the rosy picture that some research organizations and media are painting. I think the biggest problem that we have is that there's no reliable data on who has returned and who has not returned. The Census Bureau, since 2005, has simply relied on a survey that they circulate to a little over 2,000 people out of what they estimate to be 350,000 people in the city. And that is the only source of information they have on the race, ethnicity, gender, age, income of people. So my first point is that not until the 10-year census is completed, which won't be released until November, will we have an accurate picture of how many people have returned to the city. And more importantly, since the initial goal of policymakers in the city was to reduce what they called the footprint of the city, reduce the geographic size of the city, reduce the population of the city, and that culminated in a plan which is now called popularly the Green Space Plan that would have eliminated 80% of the black community. That if these were the overriding goals to make the city wider and more affluent, then it's a very important question whether or not that's been accomplished. Secondly, there's a larger question. The most recent survey research we have indicates that 75% of displaced African Americans want to return to New Orleans but cannot afford the cost of the move, or cannot afford the skyrocketing rents, or cannot find employment in a city that largely has relied on outside workers to rebuild the city.
Now, your study says that that at least 100,000 people have not returned, that the city has lost that many. This failure to count returnees seems to say that the rate of return is not a metric of success as far as the powers that be are concerned.
No, I think the initial ideas expressed by the local media and opinion makers in the white community was, in fact, that the measure of success was that we would keep most of the people out of the city. I read article that was written on December 25th of 2005 in the Times-Picayune, in which they opined that the city, which had 380,000 people in it before Katrina, it had 480,000 people before Katrina, and 70% of those, or a little over 300,000, were African American. In this article, they opined that in the year 2010, The city would have no more than 300,000 people, but more importantly, only 150,000 of those people would be original residents. So their idea of success was that we would eliminate over 300,000 of the original residents and replace them with 150,000 people who had education, better education, and more skills and could afford to live in a more affluent community. So I think it's important, it's useful to contrast the recovery philosophy of Katrina with the recovery philosophy of the Horizon oil spill. It seems to me the national consensus around the oil spill is that the victims of the oil spill, who by and large are white people in the coastal areas, that they should be made whole again, that their homes and neighborhoods should be made safe and intact, that their incomes should be guaranteed in perpetuity if the damage is permanent, and that their culture and their way of life remain intact. And I think that that's the way that it should be. That's the way that a great nation cares for people who are the victims of either a natural disaster or human-made disaster. But I think that's a very different approach, a philosophy of recovery, than what was applied in Katrina. In Katrina, the overriding policy was to disperse people and fragment their families, to not make them whole, to take 450,000 or more people outside the city, distribute them to 48 states, to 5,500 cities, and to give them all a one-way ticket out of the city, and then leave it to their own devices and resources on how to get back into the city. And so they were not guaranteed their jobs and employment. They were not guaranteed their income. They weren't guaranteed their communities, their homes would be intact, and they weren't guaranteed that they would have a safe life. Although we know now that, by and large, they were victims of government neglect, because the principal problem of the flooding in the city came from levees that were not constructed properly. Had those levees held, the waters would not have gone over the levees, and there would have been flooding in just parts of the city, but not the kind of devastation that we saw. So over a period of 5 years, we had two very different approaches to recovery. And I think in New Orleans, 5 years after Katrina, we're missing at least a third of the population. I think the census is going to show that we're missing 100 to 150,000 people. Those are overwhelmingly African Americans. 75% of them have incomes of less than 20,000. We're missing about a third of our retired people, about a third of the people that were on disability. We know even from the public schools that there are only about 58% of the students that we had pre-Katrina. Well, that means about 42% of the people who had children are not back in New Orleans. There are no efforts really being made in any way, in terms of policy, to bring them back. And I'll give you the best example. Pre-Katrina, 70% of African Americans rented. This was a renter's city. A state plan and a city plan were developed by the elites who had made it back first. In both of those plans, they did not allocate a single penny to rebuild rentals. Now, eventually, some money was forced on the state, largely by the Black Caucus, to rebuild affordable rentals, but it was just a pittance. It was about $869 million, which is just a fraction of what was given to homeowners. Homeowners were valued over renters. So it is not surprising that 5 years later, that most of the rental housing stock is empty and dilapidated and deteriorated because there really was no funding to rebuild that. and people can't come home if they don't have affordable housing. The same is true for healthcare. In the immediate aftermath of Katrina, we padlocked and closed the only public hospital in the city, although it was completely functional. It did not flood in a way that permanently damaged the building. Within about 3 weeks, the electrical system had been restored, and the hospital staff was back and ready to go to work, and the state university closed the hospital. That hospital, 5 years later, is still closed, and it was the only hospital for uninsured people, and we know that at least 30-40% of displaced people have no health insurance, so they can't return if they have no way of getting medical treatment. And that system has been replaced by a system of neighborhood clinics. These neighborhood clinics don't have the diagnostic equipment and facilities of a major hospital, and in some cases, many of those clinics are not even open to the public. There are two clinics within just about a mile of where I am right now that serve only public high schools, the public high school that they're attached to. So we have a clinic that serves 350 kids at a high school, but no one in the community could walk into that clinic and receive free medical care. So with no medical, a lack of public health care combined with a lack of affordable housing, then the final obstacle is employment. And after Katrina, I think there was a very clear policy to rely on outside temporary workers to do most of the rebuilding work. It became virtually impossible for a displaced person to find a job. In fact, it came right to the point of the ridiculous, where the hotel industry went to the Immigration Service and requested a permit for guest workers to bring workers in from Brazil to work in the hotels, on the claim that they could not find a single person in any of the displaced person shelters who was willing to come back to New Orleans and live in a luxury hotel and return to their job in full pay and have their family live with them as well. So instead, we spent, I think, close to 18 months importing guest workers, and I think it was not until really the Immigration Service cracked down on the hotels that they finally were forced to begin to rehire people who were storm victims.
We see that 85% of the white students in New Orleans go to private schools.
Well, it's a significant number because we probably have the highest percentage of white students attending private schools of any major city in the United States. What is significant about that is that it means that the white community is not invested in the public schools. So before Katrina, in the 30 years that I've lived here, I saw bond issue after bond issue defeated simply because the white voters did not feel that they had a stake in public education, and they would not invest in building new schools. They wouldn't invest in raising teachers' salaries. And that's a situation that led to what I think was a deteriorating school system. I think since Katrina, the percentage of white students in private schools is probably roughly the same, but I think there's a few, a thousand, if that, maybe a thousand, who have switched to the public school system because the charter school system that we now have, which we have the highest percentage of students in privatized schools, 60% of students now attend schools that are not controlled by the public. They're controlled by independent, self-appointed boards. There are maybe 300-400 board members in this system. I think at one point we totaled it up. There are 44 school systems for about 38,000 students because each charter school is a system unto itself. Some of those charter schools essentially took what were public schools and turned them into a private school. They have selective admission. They have selective retention. They charge annual fees up to $500. All of these are ways of creating essentially a private school that is publicly funded. And there was, I think there's a little bit of transfer from private system, but not much. There's only about one or two schools in the entire city in which there are any significant number of white students. So we included that statistic primarily to show that we have a racially segregated school system, number one, and then number two, the school system that we have, which has been privatized, and the goal is to privatize all of it, though I don't think that's going to happen, that school system is progressing at about the same rate as the school system did before Katrina. And in terms of test scores, they're progressing at about the same rate as the rest of the state. So none of the school reforms that were implemented after Katrina in any way correlate with the changes in the test scores, in the improvement of test scores.
Has the political vitality of Black New Orleans recovered in the 5 years since Katrina?
Well, this is where I think the census data comes in. It becomes a very politically volatile issue because there were people, powerful groups, and I would say it was largely a consensus in the white community, that the city should be rebuilt as a whiter, more affluent city in which white people governed the city. That was said publicly many, many times, but then became kind of something of a political embarrassment. Well, 5 years later, I think that if we take a long, hard look at the city, there's no question that the racial composition of the city has changed. And it changed in ways because of the way that district lines were drawn for the council and the school board and other offices, that large percentages of African-American population sort of fell out of those districts. It's much the way that New Orleans is built. And for instance, the council districts all kind of go from the river and fan out like a fan. And near the river, those districts are white. And as the district fans out, that's where the black neighborhoods were that flooded. Well, you could see that if you took the neighborhoods that flooded and removed them, the only people left voting in those districts are white people. So we had several city council districts that were supposed to be and were gerrymandered in 10 years ago to be majority black districts to represent proportionally the black population of the city. We lost those populations. They didn't come back, especially in the areas where there were African Americans and high rental areas. And as a consequence, we now have a city council that is comprised of five whites and two African Americans. We have a white mayor. We have a white district attorney. We have a white majority school board and a white majority legislative delegation. One could argue that either black people simply stopped voting in large numbers or that they simply aren't here. Now, I would suggest that the school population is a pretty good indicator that we're missing about 42% of the black population. And so this is the first major black urban area in the United States in which African Americans lost political governance as a result of a prolonged evacuation, disaster and a prolonged evacuation. It's unprecedented.
Since Katrina, we've had 3.5 years of Bush and 1.5 years of Obama. Has the change in federal regime had any impact on New Orleans?
Well, that's actually hard to say, and I'm not trying to waffle on the issue. Is there any initiative coming out of the White House to ensure that people have affordable housing that they can return to? Is there an initiative? We know with the what's called the Road Home Program, which was the federally funded program for people to rebuild their homes. We know that people on average got $35,000 less than what they needed. We also know that it was allocated in a racially discriminatory way because the grants were based on property values, not on the real value, the real cost of rebuilding homes. All of these require federal intervention, federal legislation, in order to remedy the problem. And at this point, that's not forthcoming. I have seen that the FEMA funds for education in particular have been expedited since Obama came into office. And there was negotiation over how much money would be spent on rebuilding the schools, and that whole process has definitely increased in its speed and also in the amount that the government is going to compensate. But, you know, I think Obama's attention is on the Gulf Coast and the Gulf Horizon oil spill, it's another disaster. But the irony here is that the disaster of Katrina is not over, especially for displaced people. But I would even say for the large number of poor people who return to the city, I don't see a difference in quality of life for most of them. In fact, in many ways, it's more difficult because I can go to every construction site in this city and count the number of African Americans on one hand. Before Katrina, that was not the case. So it seems to me that there are fewer employment opportunities for unskilled people and even for skilled workers, bricklayers, masons, and the like.
Dr. Lance Hill, speaking from New Orleans.
Our own Dr. Jared Ball is sick and tired of hearing how the Internet has opened up a brand new world of independent politics. The truth is, the Internet is fast becoming a monopoly of a few huge corporations. The digital world is politically dominated by the same toxic corporate propaganda as the rest of American media.
Obamalate is a nasty drug of delusion, and like most drugs, the method used to ingest it is less an issue than the drug itself. It may indeed be healthier to eat THC than smoke it, but both will get you high. Enough alcohol, whether in beer or shot form, will get you drunk. And whether it comes in discussions of race, war, or the economy, Obamalate still packs a punch. One powerful form of Obamalate is certainly found in discussions of Obama's use of and planned policies for the Internet. These highly intoxicated discussions include the ill-informed claims of the Internet as a mechanism for changing the racial narrative or the leveling of the political playing field in the national public sphere. More and more often these days, people are describing the use of social media and the success stories of people organizing this or that event with the use of the Internet, Twitter, or Facebook. Books today now often include some chapter about how the Internet and blogging is revolutionizing politics and media. So much so that there is even the horribly liberal and co-opting theft of the term grassroots by the unofficially Democratic Party Netroots Nation Conference, which held its fifth annual convention this summer in Las Vegas. The Internet has so captured liberal politics that they cannot help themselves but to further denigrate genuine grassroots radical politics by suggesting that such movements are being developed, in fact, can only be developed online. It is an easy and safe conclusion, but its incorrectness is simply dangerous. For instance, participants at the Netroots Nation Conference this and in recent years could be heard touting the wonders of the Internet and bringing more people into the public sphere and offering outlets for more diverse voices, especially now that 25% of Twitter users are black. As one conference participant said, with mobile devices being so popular among black and brown people, there no longer is any significant race or class-based digital divide or unequal access to the Internet. And, of course, some again uncritically applauded the Internet as being what brought young people into the process of electing Obama, and others suggested that the use of this social media played some positive role in the wake of the killing of Oscar Grant. It seems not to matter whether or not Obama is good for us, or that his Wall Street funding is what made his Internet presence what it was, or that the Internet didn't prevent Grant's murder from occurring or prevent his killer from being handed an unjust non-sentence. But this is what Democratic Party liberal politics leads to, what Fred Hampton once described as the explanations that don't explain and the conclusions that don't conclude. This past week dealt another blow to those who will soon be suffering the hangover of all this Internet Obama-laid binge drinking. Verizon and Google continued to take advantage of a weak Federal Communications Commission with a weak chair who serves a weak president. Both Obama and his FCC chair, Julius Genachowski, once said they would be champions of a free and equally accessed Internet. But as Obama has done with health care, bailouts, and wars, his appointee, Jenikowski, is bowing to media industry corporate pressure. This is a first in what is assuredly a coming onslaught of death blows to net neutrality, and will allow the two media giants to determine which websites users can access at full speed versus ones they deem unworthy. And because they are initially focused on the mobile devices most used by the poor to access the internet, the previous delusion of those devices erasing the digital divide will soon be further exposed as such. Similarly, in a separate study, it was reported that only 1% of financed internet startups are black-owned. It is this precise imbalance in corporate backing and influence that has resulted in a soft liberal political leadership that supports these and worse conclusions. This is why those who claim grassroots end up not developing any counterbalance of power and in the end support a president who claims to want to extend broadband internet while keeping it equal, but then supports an FCC chair who seems not to want to fight a previous court decision which tells him he has no jurisdiction over the internet, and who develops a national broadband strategy which, according to another report, says that by 2012, 75% of the country will have only one internet service provider offering high-speed broadband internet. At the Obama-laid stand, the internet flavor is just as popular as the others, but it's still just a flavor. Whether war, race, jobs, or the internet, this nation is simply stoned on the fundamental drug of Obama-laid.
Black Agenda Report columnist Dr. Jarrett Ball.
The media is full of stories about entertainer Wyclef Jean's candidacy for president of Haiti, but few of the stories mention that the most popular party in Haiti, the party of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the president the Americans sent into exile in 2004, is banned from running in November's election. What kind of election is it when the most popular party is shut out of the process? And who does Wyclef Jean's candidacy really serve? We asked Haitian community activist Ray LaForest.
Well, this is rather disturbing, and it would be humorous if it was of a tragic situation of the Haitian people and Haitian masses. Wyclef has achieved quite a bit. As a Haitian, you know, black person in this country, an immigrant, and it looks like many young people are proud of that. They see themselves, you know, going through Haiti, see themselves through his achievement. And also, he's been going to Haiti. He's a musician, you know, he's a star, and he has spent some money in Haiti through an organization called ELA Haiti. However, there were some other trends that are quite disturbing. One disturbing connection that he has an uncle. His uncle is infamous in Haiti. Raymond Joseph, who is the co-founder of a Haitian newspaper called Haiti Observateur, which means Haiti the Observing One, which the Haitians love to call Haiti Le Menteur, which means Haiti the Lying One. This guy has been chosen clearly by U.S. and the force that overthrew Aristide the last time in 2004, and he became the ambassador to the United States in Washington, D.C. And clearly because of U.S. influence and lack of principle of the prevailing administration, the same individual, which we consider as an enemy of the Haitian people, was kept as ambassador to Washington. This is Wyclef Jean's uncle, and we think that he's part of that grand plan. The grand plan, if you look at it, is that after the coup, after the earthquake, which is an opportunity for those people to really, now the Haitian people is on its knees, literally starving, living in the streets. Some 1.6 million people are in the streets. This is an opportunity for them to use it and redefine and bring back the whole offers and have the Haitian people having no choice but to accept it. And instead of that, the Haitian people have demonstrated, demand that Aristide, that Cueva leave the country, demand, and certainly leave power, demand that the foreign troops leave Haiti, and demand that Aristide be allowed to return, and certainly that they be part of any decision about any agenda about the future.
You spoke of Wyclef Jean's family connections, but he himself welcomed the 2004 coup, armed uprising backed by the United States against Aristide. He himself called these gangsters who came across the border from the Dominican Republic armed by the U.S., he called them freedom fighters.
Exactly. Actually, he called on his supporters to celebrate that the overthrow of Aristide. And in spite of mistakes and shortcomings, Aristide is still the most popular president in Haiti. And I can assure you that after the earthquake, when we saw people thought that whoever had been killed, because for 3 days nobody had seen him, I can guarantee that Aristide would be in the streets with the people. So what has been created is a parallel structure, which is controlled by foreigners in Haiti. First, we have Haiti is occupied one more time. The country that gave us 1804, which is the only slave revolt that ever succeeded in the history of humanity, is one more time as foreign troops stepping on the soil and dictating to its people their daily reality and their priorities. And as I said, in all those moments, white life was nowhere to be found. So now that they have imposed a structure, which is the structure that's going to control the so-called reconstruction, from which against the Haitian people has been kept out of the decision-making. This structure nominally is led by President and the Haitian minister, where clearly the foreigners have the upper hand. And I can tell you in the last press conference that President Clinton had in Haiti, the only Haitian at the table was Wyclef Jean. And so for us, this is the new pillar they're trying to make us swallow. This is the new reality, where our reality will be to compete against ourselves as the cheapest source of labor in the Americas. So that will be, as long as we are the cheapest, would be interesting to them. And this is the reality. They want to bring Disney back, paying 28 cents an hour and so on. And as we know, one of the reasons Aristide was overthrown was because he dared add a dollar per day to the salary of Haitian workers. So we see Wyclef Jean as being part of that new reality that's being unfolded. That, this is typical. They go, they invade, impose first to their substitute, especially in Haiti. They assassinate any opposition. That they literally, they take them out, they neutralize them, force them in exile, and then when things are calm enough, they use the propaganda to tell people that they have no choice but to have elections. And in this case, it's about an election. They can actually, the earthquake destroy the country, so they can really mollify everybody or the organization, neutralize them, and then the election will come after. And Wyclef is that key individual who's going to be, like Péval right now, is just nothing but a fig leaf, and Aristide will be, Wyclef Jean will be the instrument of implementation of the death plan for Haiti. And as such, this is an outrageous circumstance.
The elections that are coming up in November, of course, do not include the most populous party, Lavalas Aristide's party, which would make most observers think of those elections as being incredible, not authentic. Does Wyclef Jean's candidacy tend to give them a veneer of authenticity?
Exactly, that's the goal, because the last time they tried that, they kept the Lavalas party out of power. No more than 3% of the people participated in the election, and they want legitimacy, so they want to kind of get young people who haven't had enough experience, who don't know what they to some extent came from, and maybe don't understand all the dynamics. Be fooled into thinking that, like Wyclef himself said, he would get in the plane, he was president, go around and use what the Haitians call a coup, which is to go beg for assistance. And this is not the solution for Haitians. Clearly, our solution is to build a country that is where the decisions are made by the Haitian people and their representatives, and the implementation of those programs are also made with the participation of the Haitian people, both directly and with their own chosen government. And certainly HD's assistance, HD has been giving a lot of assistance from countries such as Cuba, which has not gotten any recognition for that, and which will be willing to work with the United States and other powers, as long as this is a deal that is made where the Haitian people benefit and where the Haitian people decide what its future should look like.
Last week, activists in the mostly black lakeshore town of Benton Harbor, Michigan, embarrassed the hell out of the Whirlpool Corporation and some of the biggest name in golf. Whirlpool is accused of trying to gentrify Benton Harbor and drive out its black residents to create a resort community for the rich. When Jack Nicklaus and other golfing greats joined Whirlpool corporate executives to open up a new luxury golf course, Reverend Edward Pickney gave them a "you are not welcome here" party.
We started out at City Hall, Benton Harbor City Hall, and I spoke to the crowd of maybe 150 to 200 people, and I explained to them why we was here. It all starts at City Hall. We got 8 black elected commissioners and 1 black mayor, and yet and still they're giving away the land to these, I don't know what word to use to explain them, but I call them land grabbers. To these individuals. So I told the crowd exactly why we was here, and we wasn't going to take this mess anymore. From City Hall, we marched to the golf course. Our plan was to, we had a, with them big megaphones that was on top of a car with 4 speakers. And what we did, we drove to the golf course, and as we was talking, we was calling out Jack Nicklaus' name. We said, "Jack Nicklaus, go home. Jack Nicklaus, go home." And each time we said that, we moved closer and closer. And then we got almost to the front of the gate. We was confronted by 14 different police officers from 4 different police jurisdictions. What they did, they didn't try to arrest nobody because we was in right. We was on public property. We wasn't on the golf course property, but we was at their gate where they, you know, if they had to come out, they had to come past us. And they was intimidated on a level that they'd never been intimidated on. Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, Tom Watson, Johnny Miller, they went out the other way because they did not want us to confront them, or they didn't want to be confronted. But we still chanted, Jack Nicklaus, go home. Jack Nicklaus, go home. Arnold Palmer, go home. Tom Watson, go home. Johnny Miller, you know we don't want you here. And then we got to the guy, one of the real Uncle Toms, guy named Marcus Robinson, and we were telling Marcus Robinson, go home. Then we got to the news media came and wanted to interview, but she's a corporate. She writes one-sided, so we called her Julie One-Sided. When I say Julie, you say one-sided. And she was so embarrassed that she had to leave, but the confrontation was good. So they called in more reinforcements, and but we stayed. We didn't stop. For about 2.5 hours, we just continued to pound them, and we just stayed on top of them. We started around about 11. We started at 10. And by 12:30, 1 o'clock, we made it to our location where we had our rally, where we had our speakers at. But it was so exciting that everybody there was definitely involved. People came from all over the country. People came to be at this rally, and it was so tremendous that, you know, I had to take my hat off to the people for the work that they done. We had Chairman Fred Hampton from Chicago. We had Ralph Porner from New York. Larry Pinckney came in. We had Kathy Talbert from Southern Illinois, Cairo. We had folks, speakers who come in and speak. We had Ron Scott from Detroit. And we had so many speakers. We had about 15 speakers. And we finished up around about 3 o'clock. But it was such a tremendous day. We definitely got our message over to the people. And we was very excited. Later on, I received a call from Whirlpool, and they want to sit down and negotiate now. But I'm not ready for them yet. Like I told them, well, let me think about it. You know, I'll make that decision when I'm going to sit down and talk with you, because I don't want none of the games that you play, and you think that black people will fall for anything. But it was a tremendous day. I tell you, the demonstration was extremely well put together, and we did the things that need to be done, and we showed them that people who come together can stand together and win. And I think that was the highlight of the whole evening, that everybody came together, black, white, Mexicans. We was there in full force, and we was excited. And they also had 130 different newspaper reporters, TV reporters, and radio reporters on hand. It was 130. They had several hundred people, and what we did, our job. We went there and we intimidated them. And that was the whole message that I wanted to send, that we're not going away. You know, we're going to stay here and fight until the end. And that was the message that we relayed to everybody. And all the speakers, more or less, they talked about Whirlpool themselves. They understand how these bloodsuckers can come in and just suck the life out of a community. And that's what they're doing. But I'm excited, though, I tell you.
What are your major demands of Whirlpool?
Well, one of the things, we're demanding them jobs. And also to stop outsourcing jobs. They outsourced 1,000 jobs just 3 months ago. Now they're doing another 216 jobs. And getting still, they're still building the Jack Nicklaus signature golf course for the rich. So, you know, the message that they're sending to us, we're going to drive you out of here. And these are manufacturing jobs that they're getting rid of. All the office jobs, with less than 1% of the people that work for Whirlpool, are African Americans who live in Benton Harbor.
And do you plan in the future to continue to disrupt the rich man's golfing experience?
Oh, absolutely. Our goal now is to get 10,000 signatures, and what we're going to do, we're going to try once a month to have a demonstration to let them know that we're for real about what we're doing.
That was Reverend Edward Pickney in Benton Harbor, Michigan.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.